Well, welcome everyone. My name is Caroline McGraw of A Wish Come Clear, and today I'm so happy to be here with Julie Barton. She is the New York Times bestselling author of Dog Medicine, a memoir about how a dog named Bunker helped her to heal from severe depression. She blogs at byjuliebarton.com, and again, I'm just so thrilled to be here with her today. So welcome, Julie.
Thank you, Caroline. I appreciate that so much.
Thank you. Well, obviously, I loved your book. I loved Dog Medicine. Got my copy right here. And when I first read it, I read the last chapter, and my husband found me curled up on the end of our couch, just sobbing. And he tried to take it away from me. And I was like, no, no, this is good crying. I love this book so much. You can't have it. You can't take it away. So, all of that said, when did you first have the idea to write this story, to write about you and Bunker?
I first had the idea the day after he died. And that only reason it wasn't like, you know, I'd always been thinking I would do it. In fact, it was quite the opposite. I thought, I'm never going to tell anybody how much I needed him, because I had shame around it. And the day after he died, I found out that I was the finalist in a fiction contest that I'd forgotten that I entered.
Oh.
And I had a 2-year-old and I was pregnant, and I just, you know, my writing life felt like this distant, faraway dream. And the fact that I heard about that contest the day after he died, when I got that email, at the same time a thought came in, and some people would say it was some kind of divine intervention, but it was as if he was saying, tell our story. In my heart, I was like, yes, I will. And in my brain, I was like, hell no. How am I gonna do that? Yeah, even like, I have a baby coming in 2 months. Like, there's no way. And so I just sort of kept it back there as a deep down sort of soul promise to both Bunker and myself that I would do my best to share our story. And so it took me, I was pregnant with my now 10-year-old. So it came out came out when she was 9 with him. But it took me about 5 years to write, but very, very part-time, because, you know, I was a man's fault.
Absolutely. Wow. And you touched on something that I think is so important, that shame that was there, that you depended on him so much and that you loved each other so much. And I've noticed that for many people, there is this taboo about talking about how much our animals matter to us and how much they impact our lives. So do you think that's one reason why this book has resonated with so many people? Because it is so vulnerable and it is so open about, like, this dog changed my life.
You know, that seems to be something that people are responding to. I had the great fortune of I'm going to be on the Dear Sugar podcast pretty soon.
Oh my gosh! That's so exciting.
Isn't it crazy? I recorded it last week. I was so nervous. Oh my God, I was going to die. But Steve said that one of the things he really liked about the book was that there was no apologizing for how needed Bunker. And let me tell you how much deleting that took to get to a place where I could do that, and how much training from very caring teachers saying you have to tell your truth. You know, it took a lot of that and a lot of me going, okay, well, this is my truth. And then the other voice going, well, you can't say that, but that is what's true. And so I'm going to just say it and close one eye and put it out into the world and see what happens. And, I do think that people appreciate that, you know, in the prologue, I say, you know, this is a story about this creature who came into my life and saved my life. And some people are going to get it and some people are not. And that's okay. But the people who get it, I see you. I mean, we're in the tribe. And I hope that there was such a tribe. I did not know. But there's definitely that tribe of people who, you know, when the world is overwhelming and everything feels scary and judgmental and hard, having a dog or a cat to hold and to be with and to return home to is literally a lifesaver.
I am 100% with you on that. Yes. I'm glad there's a tribe out there for sure.
Tribe. There, we need a name.
Yes. Oh, and that's a perfect transition too, because speaking of names, for folks who haven't read it, can you share the significance of the name Bunker and how you named him?
Yeah. So I was looking for a name, and actually my parents' first dog was named Bunker Hill. And we were just sort of tossing names around when I got the puppy. And she said Bunker Hill, and I was like, And I went and looked up the Battle of Bunker Hill. And in my little, you know, gold encyclopedias that I'd referred to throughout elementary school and middle school and probably high school. And it said that it was a battle in the Revolutionary War where the colonials didn't win, but they didn't lose too badly. And So it felt like maybe they had some hope that they could win the war. And that just felt to me like exactly where I was with depression. Because every day was, you know, every moment felt like a battle, and I didn't win many of them. Mm-hmm. But with him by my side, I felt like there was hope that, you know, he was my tank, whatever you want to call it. He was my armor to get through, you know, what had become a really difficult existence. And so it just fit. And so, you know, he went by many nicknames, but. You know, Bunkadoo, Bunker Hill, Mr. Bunny, like all kinds of things. It was also an homage to my parents who, you know, had come in and they didn't know what to do, how to help me or what I needed, but they knew I needed help and I needed something. And they were, you know, gracious enough to say, sure, bring a puppy into our house. You know, whatever you need is what we'll try to help you. Yeah, and I was very lucky to have that. You know, as much as they didn't understand depression and mental illness, they really did their very best to help me. And so I wanted to say, you know, in a way to them, they loved their Bunker Hill. He was a little beagle, and they loved him. He was in law school with my dad, and he would, like, wander around the campus, and, you know, he was, like, the mascot, apparently.
Oh.
And so, it was like I wanted a nod to him and to them.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And taking it back a bit with the clarity of hindsight, what were some of the underlying issues, the precipitating factors that really led to the worst of your depression when you were 22? You collapsed on the kitchen floor of your apartment in New York and just barely managed to call your mom and say, you know, I can't handle this. You need to come get me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I said, I can't handle this. I said, I have some kind of breakdown. And she said, stay where you are. I'm coming to pick you up. You're coming home. Mm-hmm. Because I didn't feel like I had permission to say, I want to come home, because that felt like really like a failure.
Mm.
But the precipitating events, you know, it's, there were so many, but it also, I'm a firm believer that somebody else who went through what I went through may not have succumbed to depression and may not have developed this way of thinking. May have decided, you know, the things you're being told about yourself and the things that are happening to you are wrong and shouldn't be happening. But I was not like that. I was really a sensitive kid. I was, I loved being outside. I loved nature. I loved trees. I loved my dogs. I had a room full of animals. I thought my stuffed animals were sentient beings, and I did not want to be thrown or hurt or anything.
Yes.
And I had an older brother who was probably as far opposite of that as you could get. And, you know, it was a challenge writing this book. You know, he's a happy, healthy, productive, great guy now, but it was really hard to be his little sister as a kid, being who I was. He just, when he was having a hard time, I know now he was having a hard time, he would take it out on me. And there was a lot of constant teasing, taunting, putting down, and then eventually a lot of physical violence. And, you know, I was, had stitches in my head. I was thrown against walls. I was, you know, hit countless times. And I would just, you know, I think looking back now, that should never happen. But at the time, I didn't know that that wasn't normal. My parents would say, you know, you guys have a sibling rivalry. You don't get along. Just stay away from each other. And so I thought, okay, this is a thing. This is, but when I got to be old enough to need therapy, most of the therapists said, that's not normal. Mm-hmm. You shouldn't have had experienced that. And my reaction was, you're just a wimp. You're mm-hmm. just, you don't know how it really is. You're in this la la land where you think everything's peaches and roses and everything's great. But it took probably 10 therapists to say to me, what you experienced is outside of the norm. And mm-hmm. what you experienced was sibling abuse, for me to go, maybe it is. It was really, really hard. It was really, really hard to come to terms with that. And then to also be, you know, and I think you might have written this. I was reading through your questions, this mm-hmm. whole idea of, I don't know what happened to me. I don't know if that was nothing mm-hmm. in it, mm-hmm. or if I should be absolutely outraged that nobody protected me. And I go back and forth between those things. And you know, families are so complicated. And even though I say in the book, and I say it when I speak about it, is that my parents saved me. Mm-hmm. My family saved me. They were so wonderful. And they also failed me mm-hmm. big time. And that's just how it is sometimes. And sometimes it's not so big time, and sometimes it isn't. And I think for me, being such a sensitive kid in the midst of what felt like, you know, a raging bull, was really, really scary and left me really hyper self-critical. And I didn't know that was what I was doing. Every little thing I did, you know, I would take on his persona and I would say, you're so stupid. Why'd you do that? You know, why are you so ugly? Why are you so dumb? Why, you know, just, you know, constant beating myself up. And it's still a practice that I work on very regularly, but I'm way better than I used to be. But I didn't know that was what I was doing. And so my first experience really out of the nest after graduating from college and living on my own, and things didn't go very well in New York, my first year out of college, it was just not sustainable. Mm-hmm. It was, and I tried really hard. I was like hanging on by my fingernails. But you know, when I was just daily thinking about ways to end my life, I didn't want to do that, but eventually I just had to let go. And that was what I was thinking when I was collapsed on my kitchen floor, like, I can't do this, I just have to let go. And luckily in my case, that didn't mean ending my life. It meant letting go of this, you know, independence that I wanted so deeply, and going home and trying to figure it out.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Man, yes. When I read your book, obviously, I mean, the details of our lives are so different, but I felt so grateful to you, even though I had never met you, because I felt like you were telling this piece of my story that I never read a book quite like yours. And I just was like, thank God, like, that she was brave enough to do this. Because so for me growing up, my brother was not, you know, he was cheerful, he was fun, we had a pretty good relationship. He is on the autism spectrum, so there was some communication barriers and things like that. But we had a pretty happy sibling relationship. And then when he got to be around 15, he hit puberty and it was like a switch flipped. And he just got aggressive, he got violent, he got self-injurious, and it was that raging bull, that war zone that you were talking about. I was like, yes, this is what I had experienced. And it was that feeling of just not being safe in your own home and not knowing when something terrifying would happen and how long would it last, and just that unpredictability is so scary. But anyway, backing up to what you were sharing of, like, it helped me so much to learn that the definition of trauma, like, emotional trauma, not medical trauma, is subjective, and that what one person experiences as deeply traumatic may not phase another person at all. And so for you, as someone who was so sensitive and so attuned to nature and animals and everything, and like, I could relate to this. So I remember playing with my American Girl dolls, and my friend like put the doll under a laundry basket and sat on it, and she was like, I'm suffocating her, basically. And I was like, oh my God. I was like, freaking out, because I really believed that you could suffocate a doll, you know, that that was like a possible thing. So all of that to say, I'm so glad that you were honest about your experience and what it was like for you.
You know, what I've realized is, you know, as a kid, I was often, because I think it was hard for people around me who weren't as sensitive to understand, maybe like, stop being so sensitive. It's not a big deal. And so I again, felt a lot of shame around that. But now I realize that this is actually like a superpower. It really is, because I can see what's going on with somebody, or, you know, you can just sort of feel things at a level that I think is beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you couldn't have written this book without feeling things deeply, and it, like, make this kind of art without having that sensitivity. So,
yeah. So there's one silver lining.
Yeah. And I actually, I'm finishing the draft of my memoir and my book, and on one of the chapter headings, I have a quote from Dog Medicine, and I'm paraphrasing, but it's the one about, you know, when I was hurting, I turned it inward against myself. And when my brother was hurting, he turned it outward against me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the end, just having to realize, like, we were both hurting, and I was sad that he didn't get what he needed, and that all I could do was try and take care of the girl that I was. And I love that so much.
That was, you know, a big thing to realize, is that it wasn't just that he didn't like me and wanted to hurt me. It was that he was hurting for whatever, I don't know his reasons, you know, those are his. But when I realized, like, okay, he's a good person. It's not that he's a bad human being. It's just that he was struggling as a kid, and I was not his cup of tea. Yeah. And I was also there. I was there, and I was smaller, you know?
Totally. So I've gone totally off of my script of questions, but that's okay. I write them to feel prepared, but I love just kind of taking the conversation where it's going to go. So, without giving away, you know, too much of the story, adopting Bunker was a huge step forward for you in changing those automatic negative thoughts. And I love, there's a section where you see one of your therapists and she challenges you to, you know, write down what's going through your head. And before you have even really left the office, you have like several paragraphs of self-critical thoughts. And so I wanted to ask, you know, why was identifying those so powerful for you, and where, like, what's helped you since? Where are you at with that now?
Yeah. Well, you know, she was somebody, I don't read the Goodreads reviews because of this, because somebody on there said, well, so basically describes cognitive behavioral therapy that it was annoying. Everybody knows that. And I was thinking, like, I didn't know that. So in 1996, that the way you think is going to lead to the way you feel. And when somebody pointed out to me, you know, look at how you're thinking, the moment she did that, it was like I went from looking outward and being in this inner turmoil to turning a bit back towards myself and looking in and being like, what is going on? You know, just even getting out the door of her building, you know, and I bumped somebody, and I you know, I don't remember, but like all the little details of every little thing that I was doing, where I just was ruining myself, was really, really hurting myself by thinking I'm bad and I'm stupid, and then turning around and having a happy face for people. I mean, it's torture to do that. And I think a lot of women live that way, especially young women. where, you know, they're unsure, they're scared, they're angry, they're frustrated, and yet people don't like to see young women that are that way. People like to see happy, easygoing, you know, outgoing, you know, young women. And I'm really happy to see this sort of new surge of angry young feminists. I'm like, but, you know, it was, for me, the process of turning and looking in and seeing how dangerous my thoughts were was a really big revelation. I won't ever forget that day and that building and that woman. And that said, you know, undoing, you know, a lifetime and upbringing of thinking that way is really hard. Yes. And so I still work on it. You know, I think, I mean, some people just don't get it. Like, I read an article the other day by this guy who was like, I'm always thinking, this is great. You're so great. Everything's so great. Everyone's so great. Personality, you'd be like, that totally is how he is. Like, that's got to be a great way to live. And somebody in his life was always like, you're great. Everything's great. You know, and so I don't have that. And so I've had to cultivate it. And one of the ways that I very first cultivated it was by studying animals and how non-judgmental they are, how loving they are, how unconditionally the dog loves you and is so happy to see you, thinks you're the best thing in the world. And, you know, for somebody who's so lacking self-care and self-love, that feels like, you know, a dry sponge getting a drop of water. It's just like, come on, come on, come on, you know.
Yes.
And learning that with him and feeling safe with him helped me sort of start to branch out in the world a little bit again. You know, that said, dogs don't live long enough. And so I get a lot of messages from readers saying, how did you survive after he was gone? And, you know, I won't say it's been like, oh, it was fine. I learned so much from him and da, da, da. But the fact that he existed is, I could live for another 40 years on gratitude. And then he did teach me a lot. He really did. Just about slowing down, going outside, being loving to the people who were around me. And also really being kind to myself, treating myself the way that he did and the way that I treated him, this sort of mutual, like, adoration thing where, you know, his smallest need I picked up on. And for that, he became this super awesome, well-adjusted, calm, chill, really connected dog. So, but I, you know, I still struggle with, negative thinking. And it's not as much, it's not like it used to be. But if I can find any little, it's like water in a leak, you know, like if the water will find a way in, right? You have to, it's really hard to seal a house. sometimes storm, you know, and so it's just a regular practice of really trying to stay mindful. And then, you know, some people have said over the years, you know, treat yourself like your own newborn baby. And that resonated with me a lot because I've had newborn babies and they're incredibly fragile and you love them like no other. And so that I'm like, okay, I could try that. I could try that. Just be more gentle with ourselves. I really think it would help everybody.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I love how you wrote that you felt so enormously driven to create this safe space for Bunker. And by doing that, you know, I don't think you were necessarily thinking of it at the level of, oh, this will also help me. It was just like, I really want to care for this vulnerable animal. And then a byproduct of that was helping you.
Right. I mean, it would, like, if somebody had said to me, if you care for this dog, then you're going to get a lot back.
Yeah.
It would not have been as motivating for me. It would have been like, well, I don't I don't need that. I, you know, it, there's this sort of like, I'm fine. I'm selfless. Da da da. You know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I came to be that way, but yeah, I was. Somebody said also along this journey of this book, he said, you know, people treat their animals the way that they wish they'd been treated as a kid.
Ooh.
Which that was really interesting because I, you know, protected him fiercely.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't need much protecting. I mean, he had a really charmed life, but I'll never forget the neighbor who used to put out food for a feral cat when we were living on the East Coast, and he somehow discovered it.
Oh.
Wandered over there one morning, and she chased him out of her front porch with a broom.
Mm-hmm.
I was like, this is before we had kids, and I could feel like I was becoming a grizzly bear. I was like, don't even go there with this dog. Don't even.
Yeah.
I lost it on her. I mean, because that was me, in a way, protecting, you know, the little me.
Mm-hmm.
Don't hurt him. He is this innocent, beautiful soul, and I'm going to protect him every ounce of my being. And I think that was healing for me because, you know, if I couldn't necessarily get that as a kid, I could give it, and that made me feel like, okay, well, I'm doing some good here, and I'm undoing some things in myself.
Yeah. Yeah, I wrote down this quote from Dog Medicine. I couldn't imagine treating myself kindly with gentle understanding, but I could, without question, do that for my dog.
Mm-hmm. No question. And a lot of the training books were really good in that regard, too, because they, you know, that the sort of like, dogs aren't going to learn from negative reinforcement. They're going to learn from positive reinforcement. So, you know, when they do catch them doing something good, if they do something bad and you don't notice it for 10 minutes, they're not going to know why they're in trouble.
Yep.
You know? And
yep.
So that was actually really helpful to read that and be like, okay, positive reinforcement helps. Okay. But that was not easy, especially as a young 20 something. I could not, that was not a language that I spoke.
Mm.
And so doing it towards my dog was a way to have that kind of tenderness and beauty in my life that I couldn't bring towards myself or humans. I didn't trust people. I didn't feel safe. I didn't feel like, you know, I would be judgment-free, you know, in a judgment-free zone. I didn't feel like I would, you know, have a good time necessarily. I was always just waiting for somebody to really hurt me.
Yep.
Never with a dog. And so I could relax. And then in turn, I was just wanted to give him the best life ever.
Yeah. And I love the part where you guys go to meet your former boyfriend, and you and Bunker, and he's kind of not super into the dog. He's kind of like, oh, is the dog going to be around? And I just love in this moment, you're like, I knew that it was not going to work out and I didn't need it to work out. And you're like, if you can't accept this animal that I love so much, then like, see you
that
later.
That was like, I mean, I'm not like, you know, and I say in the book, like it wasn't that wasn't like the last time I saw him and it wasn't like, but I was like that deep down back thing. I was like, yeah, no,
yeah,
not that bad.
Yes. And on the flip side, of course, then you have Greg, the man who became your husband, is introduced in the book, and his seeing his relationship with Bunker and having Bunker kind of helping you to build that trust. Do you think that kind of opened the door for your relationship with Greg?
Yeah, I do. I really do. I think that a lot of it was because I had this relationship that was my primary relationship with Bunker.
Mm-hmm.
I actually was in the first time in my life, really, as a young adult, where I didn't feel like I needed a boyfriend. I always felt like I needed somebody who was going to show me love. And once I had Bunker, I was like, I don't need a actually pretty nice to not have to worry about that.
Yeah.
And so when he came along, I didn't need him. And that was a new kind of interest for me because I was very attracted to him and I thought he was hilarious and super smart and great to be around. And without, you know, in my past, I would have been like all for that, but I was like, yeah, I don't know if that's what I want right now. But the more that I saw him both interact with Bunker and with other people in the world, I was like, okay, maybe that is what, like, so there was this moment where I realized that all my other sort of past relationships were this, like, I need you and it's passionate and you have to be here. And it's like, oh my God, we can't be apart. And then fights. And then, but it was really calm and easy with Greg. And, we were just friends. We got along. It was fun. It was easy. There was no stress. When he was gone, I wasn't worried about where he was or who he was with. You know, it was just like, it was easy. And I was like, maybe that's how it's supposed to be.
Whoa.
And because I had felt that with Bunk. You know, I didn't worry about Bunker, you know, being, you know, I don't know, liking someone else better.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. It brought me to a healthy enough place where I could see that somebody who was kind and, you know, trustworthy, I guess, is not quite the word I'm looking for, but like, calm, genuine, kind, easygoing, not possessive, you know, that could be a good match. Mm-hmm. And then it turned out that he was not scared off by me when I had my meltdown around him, which felt like a miracle.
Yeah.
And that's not to say he wasn't scared, because he was just like, whoa. But he also didn't run away and he didn't avoid it and he didn't say stop, you know. So that was like, okay, I think he's a keeper.
Definitely. Definitely. Yeah. I was just rooting for you guys the whole time. I was just like, I really hope this guy sticks around. Like, I really want them to stay together.
And then they read it and they're like, God, why is she so stupid? No. When you write memoir, you have to write the moments you're not very proud of.
Yes.
And it's really hard and vulnerable. And some people read the book and they get very angry about that, or they get very angry that I had such a rough upbringing, which is really interesting. A lot of people say, I didn't want to read such a sad book, or I was very angry at her parents.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I do this, and that's a really interesting reaction to me. Like, I really wish I hadn't gone through it either.
Yeah.
But, you know, writing these stories, you have to write the good, bad, and the ugly, because otherwise, you know, you write a story about how great your life is and how everything was awesome, and then you got a great dog, and then you met a great guy. Everything, right? It's like boring. Nobody wants to read that because nobody lives like that.
Yeah.
So you have to write those ugly moments, and once you flex that muscle of exposing yourself and sharing it with other people. And exposing your vulnerable, your mistakes and all the dumb things you've done. What I have discovered is not only are people kind, wonderful, and for the most part, just 100% warm and accepting. They're just really grateful.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, oh, me too. Or I did something just like that. Or, oh, I get it. And then you feel a little bit, you know, feel less alone.
Absolutely. Wow.
Yeah, right?
And I think you did a great job, for me at least, like in portraying both your brother and your parents, just and yourself, of, you know, like you said, there wasn't a bad guy and a good guy. It was just, we were all just humans. We were all just struggling in our different ways and doing the best we could, even if we look back and we're like, oh, our best was terrible. Like, you know, but in that moment, right, that was what you knew. Like, you said, your mom had read that if siblings were fighting, you were supposed to ignore them because it was a bid for parental attention. And so I could see how, with that thought in mind, you know, she thought maybe she was being helpful when you were like, why did no one help me? Like, this is not helpful.
Yeah. I mean, she told me as an adult that she hid under the bed when she would hear us. And, you know, it's misguided, but it's what she read somewhere. Some expert said, you know, siblings fight for this. And, you know, she was trying. She was doing her best. And so, you know, the ways that they, that everybody in my family, the ways that we hurt each other and the ways that we failed each other, you know, are outweighed by the ways that we have stayed together and loved each other. Mm. And, you know, that I know this is one of your questions, like the writing of this story.
Yes.
Was, I didn't know how they were going to react to it. And they had every right to say, you may not publish this. But they were incredibly gracious. And there's some good stories just about my dad and my mom and my brother and all of them reading it and really surprising me with their support. And yet I say surprising me, but I shouldn't be surprised because they're really great people. You know, my brother read it after waiting a few months and was really kind and posted on social media that he finished the book and he loved it, except it made him cry in the airport. And
oh, wow.
It was so sweet. And then my parents had them read it. And they were flying to come visit me.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were like, we're going to read it on the plane on the way to see you. And I was like, okay.
Oh God. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I'm like at the airport, like sweating bullets, like, you know, how's this going to go? And are we going to have to like have some sit down long talk? And is it going to, and they got off the plane and they both probably looked like you did after you finished. It just,
mm-hmm,
you know.
Mm-hmm.
And my first thought was like, oh no, like they're devastated. And
mm-hmm.
my mom kind of like, she was like, I can't talk. And my dad wiped his eyes and he said, this is going to be a New York Times bestseller.
Wow. He was right. Like, yeah.
Well, at that time, you know, it wasn't, you know, I had a teeny tiny publisher and I didn't have any plans for that. I just wanted it to, have it out in the world. And I wanted one person to find it who it would help. Because mm-hmm. there was this image of a girl who needed this book. And I was like, I want to just find her and I'll be satisfied. And so it was, you know, it was very sweet of him. It was very daddy, you know, fatherly, like, it's going to be the best book ever.
Yes.
You know, it was so supportive. And my mom said parts of it were hard. But she loved it. And then my dad tried to listen to the audio version and he said he couldn't, because of the sections with the violence. So, he read it. So, and they've just been great.
Wow.
Again, I think, you know, one of the last sort of edits that I did based on Pam Houston's advice was to do a compassion read.
Ooh.
And just make sure that everything I'm saying in there is weighed equally from every perspective. Because if you're writing a memoir and you want to talk about how someone hurt you, you can't just say this person's a terrible person and they were evil and da da. You just can't, because nobody is. You know, there's reasons we're doing what we're doing. I mean, unless they're a sociopath or something, but there's motivations, there's hurt, there's confusion, there's misunderstandings. You have to really weigh, like, what was going on for this person? And for me, it took me a good few years of asking my family questions and studying them and being like, oh, that was what was going on, and a lot of therapy. And so I think that maybe one of the reasons that it didn't sting too badly for them was that they were represented as honestly as I could. And by that, I mean, they were represented with a lot of love, because they certainly showed me a lot of love, even though they failed me at times, they didn't mean to ever.
Yeah. Wow. That gives me so much hope. I mean, that's amazing.
Yeah. Just, you know, if I think most people, if you just represent them as fairly and as lovingly as you can, even the bad guys, you know, another teacher, I worked with Steve Allman several years ago, and that was one of the things he said. He said, love all of your characters. Because if you don't, your reader's not going to trust you. You have to love all of them and come at them with love, even when it's somebody in a memoir who's wronged you. You have to come at them with love. And just living that way is actually really, really nice.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, I feel like, tell me if this is your experience too, but just the process of writing these stories and writing them down and having to come at your characters with love. I mean, it's obviously you want the book to find its readers, but just writing it that way and just going through that exercise changes you as a person of, okay, I can't stay within the same story of, oh, I was hurt, I was this, no one took care of me, it was all bad. Right. And by writing it all down, you have to kind of step out of that and step into kind of like the watcher or the director's seat and just like look at it from a broader perspective. And yes. That's very healing.
It's really healing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
It's really healing to do that. Yeah, because you get to see, okay, this actually wasn't, you know, for me, it was like, this wasn't because I was unlikable or a bad person or, you know, whatever, all those things I was told. It was because of all these other factors. And then you can, it sort of opens a door to start to really heal.
Exactly. It's totally. And it's so easy to stay stuck in that, like, you know, if only I would have done something different, or what's wrong with me, or that, like, kind of that thinking that it all comes back to me. But then you're zooming out and you're like, oh, wait, there are all these other dynamics at play that actually have nothing to do with me and predate me. And like, you know, it's, I'm not the only factor here, obviously.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah, it's really, really, it's one of the biggest benefits of writing a memoir, I think. You know, but then you also have to expose your ugly.
Yes. I forget who said this, but it was super helpful to me reading the idea that, like, make yourself look the worst of anybody, but not in, like, a self-deprecating way, but just in the sense of, like, reveal more of your own weaknesses and failings and be more open about those than even about the other characters. And I was like, oh, that's so freeing, because if I know, okay, I'm writing me as the most kind of, like, misguided character, then I can go easier on everybody else, sort of.
Well, and so. Also, when you're writing yourself as a misguided character, you can thoroughly explain why. Mm-hmm. You know, you can thoroughly explain why you thought what you thought. You can't do that for somebody else. You can't explain, you know, thoroughly their motivations and their deep down thought, but you can for yourself, which is why when you write yourself as the most flawed character, it doesn't come out, you know, weird or, you know, like, I'm just trying to be self-deprecating, or I'm just trying to be so, you know, flawed that you'll either feel really sorry for me, or, you know, hope that I can, you'll love me because I'm so flawed. It's not that at all. It's like, you can really explain it, that you can't with other people. You have to just write what you saw. And then I think, you know, also for, like, in mine, you know, I couldn't write in the childhood scenes that my brother was hurting.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Sort of try to hint at it a little bit, but I didn't know that then.
Right. Really,
or if I did, I didn't know that that had a relationship to how he treated me.
Mm-hmm,
it was
mm-hmm.
later in life where I was like,
Yes. That makes so much sense to me that, like, when I worked with an editor, she kept reminding me that, you know, just stay in what you knew at that moment. You don't have to explain what you figured out about it 5 years, 10 years down the road of, can you write this scene just from the teenager's perspective or just from the child's with what they were knowing then? And on one hand, that was really hard because I wanted to be like, but don't worry, later I figured out X, Y, and Z or whatever. Like, I want to reassure everybody. And because back to what you were talking about of, like, the stuffed animals have feelings and we want to make sure everyone is okay. But it was actually, yes. And it was, like, really helpful to have to just explain it from the perspective I had then, because it made things make sense. And then I also had more compassion for the me back then and everyone else back then, because it was like, oh, you are working with this very limited perspective. Of course you thought this, you know?
Absolutely. Why? Yeah. How else would you come to any other?
Right. It was, you know, you were 6 years old. Your brain was like not even close to being finished developing. Like, you didn't have a very nuanced interpretation of this. You were six. Like, what did you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That's so true. So true. And that's, I think you're right about the healing power of writing and sitting and writing it down. Because, you know, people ask me that a lot. Like, were those really hard scenes really traumatic to revisit?
Mm-hmm.
And the answer for me, it may be like that for some people. But it was no, it was not at all traumatic. I was eager to put those on the page because once they were on the page, they became real again in a way. Mm-hmm. And I could write down the nuance, the detail, the emotional memory that I had, which took it away from this thing I'm holding.
Yes.
And I put it on the page and it was like, now it's there. And I don't have to worry about what's happening with it and where it goes from there, but it's out of me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes.
And that for me is like, what else can I write? When I write down more scenes for me to write, and write them down. And I found that really, really, I mean, some people are like, well, this is very cathartic to write. And so, and I resist that a bit, but it kind of was.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That rings true for my experience too, that it might seem scarier to get it out of your head and onto the page, but actually once it's on the page, it's much more manageable. And you're also kind of coming at it, like, it's almost like as a writer, I can't resist thinking about it as a writer. So I have to sort of depersonalize it a little bit because there's a part of me that's thinking, oh, this is a thing that happened. But even writing about like my first breakup, it's obviously this was a long time ago, but seeing it on the page, it's like, okay, it's not just what was my experience of it. It's like, what makes sense and what pieces of it do I tell? And having to kind of be strategic with it is...
Totally.
It almost makes it fun in a weird way. Like,
what do you reveal and what are readers going to take from that? And it's the same kind of thing you're talking about, wanting to reassure people like, later on in life, I figured this out. Don't worry.
Yeah.
You actually need to put yourself in that place where the reader's going to worry about you.
Yeah.
To be like, oh man, like, is she going to be okay? I don't know. Because you were in a place where you needed to be worried about. So was I.
Yeah. That is a great point. That's a great point. And I did, maybe that's part of why, obviously this is only the first time we've ever spoken, but I feel as though I felt connected. I feel like I know you, maybe because I worried about you in the book of like, is Julie going to be okay? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, that's, you know, that's some of the best sort of writing instructors I've had in terms of structure. There needs to be this, like, what are you worried about? What's, you know, what are you hoping is going to happen? What's at stake here? And, mm-hmm. you know, in the story, it was really just my life. Am I going to make it? And am I going to be well enough to survive? And, you know, I think that that's important. People need to read it hoping for something.
Yes. Yeah. I was definitely invested. No doubt about that. Thank you. Oh my goodness. Yes. It's funny, actually, I was joking with my husband of if there had to be one interview that I was going to do today, I was glad it was this one because I'm editing the last chapter. So I'm really, really close. I'm like getting down to it. And it was like, I don't want to have to stop, but I really want to talk to Julie Barton, but I don't want to have to stop, but I really want to talk to Julie. So it was a good motivator.
I know that momentum of wanting to be like this. So thank you.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to forget to ask, just as a last question, to talk about this book's publishing journey, because it was very unique. And you did start off, like you said, with a small press with Think Piece Publishing, which is how I got to read it, because Adam Wahlberg published a short Kindle single of mine in 2013. And he said, you know, I have this amazing memoir. I think you would love it. You need to read it. And so then Dog Medicine then ended up with Penguin and ended up on the New York Times bestseller list. So how did all that happen? What was that journey?
It was crazy. It was crazy. Don't you just love Adam Wahlberg?
We need to start with that. Hi, Adam. We think you're fantastic. Yes.
Fantastic. Yeah. You know, it couldn't have gone in a better trajectory for me because if I had gone straight to a big press, I don't think it would have been a good experience. Starting out with a small publisher who said, you can, this is your book, this is your baby. You can decide the cover, you can, you know, you have final editorial say, I'm not going to change anything dramatically, I'm just going to help copy edit, and then I'm going to work my tail off to get this out into the world, which he did. You know, that, it was just great. I felt safe. I felt, I didn't feel like I was, you know, being changed at all. I felt like this was my authentic work. This was 100% me. There was no other influence in it. And so that was a great way to start. You know, we did a little self-toured tour, self-funded tour. And he flew out to California. He's in Minnesota. And it was just, it was great. It was great. And I was happy. I was happy with that. The thing was that the, we did a, I can't remember the number, but it was, for him, it was a pretty aggressive printing. And, they sold out faster than we could print them. And part of that was because of the way Amazon worked, and just it, for a small press, it's hard with physical books, it's hard, to really get the attention of, well, obviously, like, you know, getting in bookstores, getting good distribution. There's sort of a monopoly on that with the bigger houses. It's not a monopoly, but they have just a lot of influence. And so, you know, that was a little bit of a bummer for me that, like, I would just go into a bookstore and it wouldn't be there unless I'd gone in there and been like, hey, I live around the corner. This book, you know. I was like a little sad about that, but I was also like, you know, my dream of this one girl is was fulfilled right away. You know, I started getting messages from people. Then, oh, well, so before it came out with Think Piece, a friend of mine sent it to her agent. It was this lovely New York agent. And she called me before it came out with Think Piece and said, this, I could publish this with a big house. But I was already like two thirds of the way down the road with them, with Think Piece. I was very loyal, and I just thought, I don't really want to do that. And so I said, you know, no thanks.
Yeah.
And then about 2 months after it came out, I was in Portland doing a radio show on a little self-funded tour, and I got a phone call, and it was a New York number, and I was like, that's weird. It was the same agent, and she said, how would you feel if I told you I have an offer from Penguin? And I was like,
oh my gosh. So this is Marley Roussoff now calling you. This is your agent. Okay.
Yeah. And she had, unbeknownst to me, given it to an editor at Penguin who loved it and wanted to buy it. And then, so I talked to Adam, and they didn't, they wanted, it was like this whole thing with reverting the rights back. And a lot of small presses don't do that because they're like, okay, this is our successful book. This is our moneymaker. But he was such a generous and kind soul. He was like, all right, let's figure out a way to make this work. Wow. And he gave me the feedback. You know, and I gave him as much as I could, and we worked it out. And then it came out again in July of last year, and I did a 14-city tour and all kinds of press, and it was very interesting. You know, I saw myself in airports, which was
wow.
25 pictures of different airports, like, look, here it is, here. You know, it was there in it Target. Is. Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it was. Got a little addicting after a while. I mean, this is silly. But yeah, it was an interesting and really different experience. You know, the editors that I met with, you know, worked with there were lovely. The big houses, you know, the people living, well, small is better, big's better. Everybody I've met at all these places are fantastic people because they're book people. And they want art to help heal the world. And no matter where you work, if you do that, I think you're all-star. So I had a great experience with everything, and then got the phone call that the book was a New York Times bestseller, and I was speechless for about 10 seconds. And then the first thing I said was, I gotta tell my dad.
That's perfect. I gotta talk to dad.
And they knew that story, so that was really cool.
Wow. He knew. Yeah. He saw it coming.
I don't know, take him to the racetrack or something.
Right, right. Put that talent to good use. Well, I want to honor your time. You've been so generous to me to talk this long. But any final words or thoughts that you wanted to share with folks who are listening?
Well, you know, one of the questions that I get is, do you have a dog now?
Yes.
Show you guys.
Let's see the dogs. Show us the dogs.
Yeah, this is our recent, we were fostering her for Christmas. And
Oh, hello. Hi.
And she's old. She had her teeth pulled and she
Sweetie.
She was 5 pounds. Now she's 8 pounds.
Oh, you're a sweet one. Hi, sweet girl. Oh my goodness.
So she's a sweetheart. She's a little heart dog. And then Jackson, come here. I'm sleeping. He's down here. I'll show you. He's down there. Jackson! See my paint buckets. Jackson!
Oh, he's a sleepy bunny. Oh my goodness. He's like, no. I'm down. He's like,
a lap sitter, so she'll be happy to. You want to be on the camera?
Nice. Oh my goodness. Well, that's the perfect way to end of like, hey, look, there are even more animals to love.
Yeah, there really are. And animals that, you know, need to spend their final years in some
place. Amen. Yes. I'd go adopt. That would be my call to action.
Yeah. There's so many beautiful little fools out there who want love. We want to bring love. So. Yeah, so I do have two dogs. They're no Bunkers. I mean, I love her, but, you know, he came at a special time in my life.
So. He was one of a kind. Yes, I found that so amazing, too, that probably the day he was born was the day that you collapsed. That was incredible. I mean,
I didn't know that or make that connection until I really thought about it and spent time and then looked back and was like, oh, my gosh. And then the more I looked at that, the more I was like, there's something cosmic going on here.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of really beautiful connections, and there still are. Right? Doesn't she look like Dobby the house elf?
She does. She does completely. Oh, yeah. My goodness. Thank you, Julie. Thank you, Dobby the house elf.
That's right.